Hey, and welcome everyone to Your Money, Your Matters. We're certainly glad that you are here with us again on this very fine, fine Tuesday. And or Wednesday, if you're on the other side of the international dateline, that's quite all right. You can be there as well. Well, we wanted to welcome you here, and certainly we are looking forward to talking with you on Blog Talk Radio. And if you would like to participate, you can give us a call, and the phone number is 646-929-1020. That is 646-929-1020, and you press the number one key. That will raise your digital call. I'll be able to see that, and I'll be able to bring you on the air. Or you can go into the chat room. The chat room is up and live and running, and so you can put your questions in there or concerns in there, and we'll try to address them from there. So we are certainly glad that you are here with us. This is Rick Grady with the Cornerstone Credit Union League, and Tom Bark is here with Navicore Solutions, and we're going to see if we can brighten up your Tuesday as the market goes zinging and zanging all over the place. I'm just kind of making squiggles like it had a little bit of a tremor here, about a 3.4 on the Richter scale. nothing serious. A couple little cranks here and there, but that's about it, to be real honest.
Yeah. You know, just as we promised last week, we're going to talk a lot today about the cost of college and really helping families, not just the kids, but the parents as well, analyze the return on investment of going to college.
Mm-hmm.
But before we do that, you can't help but get caught up with the news, you know, with daily updates on your smartphone or whatever website you like to go. So yesterday, Monday the 24th of August here, 2015, we had an unprecedented 1,089-point drop to start the day on the Dow. And, of course, that signaled to many people, the sky is falling. Everything I know doesn't exist in reality anymore, and I should throw out whatever my plans, whatever they've been for the last 6 months, the last 6 years. If you've had a good financial planner working with you for 20 or 30 years, well, obviously this changes everything. And I want to tell you that it's a very personal issue to me because as a long timer, not just with Navicore Solutions, but in the credit counseling industry and counseling people that deal with financial crisis, the worst thing you can do when it comes to investing is panic.
Yep.
And we could go back through countless examples of this, but I go back just go back a few years ago during the height of the Great Recession. And we had a Monday through Thursday when each day was spikes and drops of, I think it was 600, 700, 800 points each day, and people didn't know what to. Oh, it's a one-day correction. We're back up. No, it's falling again. And I know a lot of people that I've counseled over the years that made them so ill, Rick. They said, I can't stomach the thought that my money could disappear, like 30% of it could go away in a matter of a week, and I needed to pull out of investing. And I needed to go and do something that was safer. And I thought I should go and do savings accounts, which here we are, we're 7 years later from the start of the Great Recession, and our interest rates are still at ridiculously low, non-existent. So let me tell you.
We're paying them.
Yes. So if you were one of those people that panicked during the Great Recession, you said, this investing is for fools. Well, what you've missed out on is a 220% increase in the overall stock market since the bottom of the recession.
Yeah.
A lot of growth. And what you would have received is 0.0 negligible on your interest in some sort of conservative savings vehicles. So you would have gained nothing, but many people would have pulled out of investing because they were afraid of losing everything. You have to remember that economies are cyclical, but historically, you go back over time, prior to the recession, you would have a pretty much guarantee a historic rate of 12% annual returns if you're invested broadly across the U.S. stock market.
So
if you're doing the S&P 500, the 500 largest companies. Now, are there years that there's downs? Of course there are. And if you are somebody who is, I don't know, 67, and you are contemplating retiring this month or this coming year, should your reaction be maybe slightly different than the rest of the general public? Well, yeah, because your timeline is changed, and you want to limit your exposure to today's up and downs.
Mm-hmm.
But for everybody else, what happened yesterday would be like going to Walmart and they said, guess what? Our already low prices we're marking at 5% off. Or just 5% off anything. Anything you want to buy, it's 5% off.
Yep.
It's people say, well, what does that mean? There was no discount. Yes, there's a discount if you bought yesterday.
Yeah, yeah.
If you were buying yesterday morning while a lot of other people were selling due to the turmoil going on in China and other parts overseas, reminding us that we are part of a global economy, you were selling as things were falling, breaking one of my cardinal rules of investing, which is buy low, sell high.
I mean, let's put this in a little bit of context for people so that they understand.
Please.
In the first place, yesterday's drop of 1,000 points or over 1,000 points was blown out of proportion, and I'm going to use those words, blown out of proportion by the news media, who always look for something dramatic to talk about. That is, they won't tell you the good news, they'll just tell you the bad, because bad news sells. Really, if you looked at it from a percentage standpoint, there was about a 3% correction in the market yesterday, because that's about what 1,000 points at the market equalizes out to be, and it was about a 3% correction. So that's, you know, in a nutshell, if you were to look at that and compare that to 2008, 2009, when 50% of the value of the market went away, there's hardly any relationship between the two of them. The other thing that you have to take a look at is what is stimulating it within the market. You know, back in the 2008, 2009 Great Recession, it was stimulated first by a housing downturn, a significant housing downturn. That downturned construction, that downturned manufacturing, and then the high elevations of homes that were purchased during that period of time, people started not being able to pay on their mortgages because they basically mortgages were made to people that had either very little income or no income. Nobody ever checked. And so the investment market went away, and then the banks crippled. So when you see all of that, the housing industry falling, construction falling, manufacturing falling, the banking industry falling, the investment industry falling, you're going to get a significant dive in the market space. And that's what stimulated the 2008-2009 recession. What's stimulating it now? Well, there's still a little bit of, you know, ripple going on in Europe as far as them being able to step forward into their economy. Germany certainly has had a very strong economy. Great Britain has had a strong economy. France has had a fair economy. Spain, Italy have had an okay economy, and Greece has had a horrible economy. But you take a look at the countries there and to see how they spend their money, you begin to realize that there is no gross domestic product. They're not doing any exports. What they're importing is money. What they're doing is spending it all. And so the countries went into significant debt. They are not able to produce any goods or services that are sold outside of their country, other than, you know, maybe olives and pistachios. And so there was no way of paying back all of the debt. So Europe is reeling from that a little bit. Spain has had some problems with overspending. Italy had problems with overspending. France had problems with overspending. And again, remember, look at the countries and see how they did that. And what we realize at that point in time is that just like you and I, we can't continue to spend and spend and spend and spend and run up a whole bunch of debt with very little income and not be able to pay off our debt when the debt comes due. So Europe has contracted a little bit, and they're not importing. Now, China, on the other hand, has been exploding. They have done more construction than they should have. They've been expanding in many areas that they should have. A lot of people have realized, because of social media and other things, that there are higher wages that they could get, and so they've been demanding higher wages. And inflation has gone through the roof. So China has been trying to reduce their inflation down to 7%. Now, The United States feels that we operate very, very well on about a 2-2.5% inflation. So if we have 2-2.5% inflation, we're operating okay. We're way below that. So that's why, you know, no changes in interest rate. But China's been operating in the tens. So this is a significant inflation in that, you know, people just, you know, you can't from month to month to month be able to afford the costs of goods and services. So they've got to bring it down so people can afford to buy stuff. And so they're hoarding money and they're not buying anything. So they're trying to bring it down to 7, and they basically put the brakes on and said, look, we're not going to import stuff anymore, period. I mean, you know, our imports are going away. And so everybody got scared at that because, who do they import the most from? Well, the United States. They import a lot of agriculture from us. They import a lot of commodities from us. In turn, some of those commodities, like cotton, they turn into clothing, and they ship it back to us and sell it back to us. So, you know, they buy the cotton, they do something to it, they add value to it, they ship it back to us as a good, and we buy it back. You know, China is trying to reel in their economy a little bit so that their people can begin to afford some of the stuff that they actually manufacture. And so it's caused a little bit of a ripple. It's not a real big ripple, though. I mean, the financial industry is not crippling. Banks did take it in the knee yesterday. There was a lot of sell-off on banking stocks, and they all came back today.
Yep.
Because people realized, you know, it wasn't in the banking atmosphere. It was a couple of countries that decided they're going to cut back. And so there was what I would call a mild correction took place yesterday. And just to keep our, you know, our eyes on our own finances, just like you and I, when we have money and we put it into something, we're not going to take all of our money and put it into one thing. Like the stock market, we're going to diversify, and so we're going to put some in what you would consider low risk. And the older you are, the closer you are to retirement, the more you're going to have into low risk and high yield than you're going to have in a high risk, low yield type of situation. And so you invest it in bonds. And a lot of times when you invest it in bonds, you invest it in what they call munis, municipal bonds, because if you looked across the United States, in most states right now, property values are going up, and when property values go up, more tax dollars come into the coffers of the city, and the city is able to pay off the bonds that they have and thus issue new bonds. So that's what they're going through right now, is issuing new bonds, and they're paying off their debts to the bondholders. And so it's actually a very low risk because tax dollars will pay the bonds.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that, you know, all in all, if we looked at it, we had a market correction yesterday. It basically was a wake-up call to realize that we have, when we came out of the recession, and I think part of it is the press and part of it was euphoria on Wall Street, is let's break another record. Let's break 16,000, then let's break 17,000, let's break 18,000, oh, let's go for 20. Well, those stocks and the market cap values of those stocks weren't worth what they were, and we needed to correct that, and it was corrected.
Yeah. So if you're somebody that has a plan, and let's say you're a buy and hold,
mm-hmm.
and you dollar cost average every pay period, you have money taken out of your paycheck, and it's deposited in and invested, and maybe it's going into bonds, maybe it's going into cash,
mm-hmm.
maybe it's going into individual stock purchase. Some corporations you work for, you'll be putting into a stock buying plan, and that's part of your retirement. Maybe it's invested through one of the large mutual fund or index fund companies,
mm-hmm.
Where you're getting lots and lots and lots of stocks all at once in one big fund. So if you do that, you don't pay attention to the news on a daily basis.
You don't, no.
You just don't. And,
yeah.
And it's really,
quit listening to the closing value of the stock market every day.
Rick, it's the people that get caught up, and even if you had a perfect plan,
mm-hmm.
and it's worked for you for 10, 15, 20 years, and you say, but today it all goes out the window,
mm-hmm.
so I'm going to ignore it. Those very people that cashed out in 2008 are the ones that are saying, wow, I wish I was taking a 1,000-point dip yesterday Because that means I also would have taken the roller coaster ride up of, you know.
My advisement yesterday would have been buy as much Apple stock as you can get your hands on.
Yeah.
You're buying it at a discount.
Now, and again, we don't really give investment advice here. We like to talk about your money, your matters, being smart with it, being a good saver, spending less, saving more, not getting ripped off, all of those things. But it's almost like ripping yourself off.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got a plan that you believe in, and then you say I'm gonna panic.
Yeah.
So let's say this: if you were somebody that has one stock, and you read on the news, this company may be going bankrupt. That's a different story.
Mm-hmm.
That would be your time to panic.
Mm-hmm.
If you were broadly exposed through the stock market, and you have mutual funds, you have index funds, mm-hmm. I have a lot of my money. Thankfully, in my years with Clark Howard, he made sure that the radio station used Vanguard and John
mm-hmm.
Vogel, the founder of index funds, but it's also one of the cheapest places to get index funds.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some of the best financial planners in the world say, this is your broadest exposure, and you don't have to think. Just make a contribution every pay period.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And guess what? My money has grown astronomically
mm-hmm.
in the 20 years I've been in the workforce. And it's really simple.
Mm-hmm.
You act. You put together your plan, and you act on your plan, and generally it will work.
Mm-hmm.
So when I said that it was a 12% annual return on the stock market prior to the recession,
mm-hmm.
and depending on your stopping point, I don't know if they've measured counting now, because obviously we had a significant period of loss and then a significant uptick
mm-hmm.
since then. But going into it, annualized 12% per year included all the bumps and all
mm-hmm.
the bruises, included years where there were losses.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't have a very short timeline, you should have blinders on.
Yeah, and the thing that amazed me yesterday was that gold held its price. It basically was at about $11.59,
mm-hmm.
and it stayed at $11.59. What people were throwing money into was the United States government. They were buying treasuries, which goes to show you how strong the United States government is and how strong they think the United States financial system is,
mm-hmm.
because they wouldn't be buying treasuries if they thought it was weak. I mean, you wouldn't buy Greece treasuries today, but you know, a lot of foreign countries have been stuffing money into the United States.
Mm-hmm.
It's a safe bet.
Yep.
So that just goes to show you how strong the economy is over here.
Yeah. Well, I say this personal because my dad is one of those people that watches CNBC or MSNBC. And throughout the day.
God bless him. I mean,
I talked to him on Monday,
mm-hmm.
and I said, how are you doing? He goes, I've lost so much money today. I said, you haven't lost anything. did you sell off some stock? Did you sell shares from your index fund? No, but the valuation is lower today. And I said, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And it'll be higher tomorrow. And by the way, it is. And then when we started the show, the Dow was up over 400 points. So
mm-hmm.
so you've already got most of the loss yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
It's gone.
Yep.
So a 200 point swing over 2 days on a
mm-hmm.
17,000 basis. Who cares? It's negligible.
Just think of it as a fun ride at Six Flags.
Yeah, it's up. But my dad. Oh, I don't know if I can take it. And I've talked to him about the Swan factor. And for the long term listeners of our show, Your Money Your Matters. You know, I've always said Swan stands for sleep well at night.
Mm-hmm.
If you were somebody that can't sleep well and you're worried about your exposure, you're worried about your liability when it comes to
mm-hmm.
exposure in the stock market, or exposure to any investment, I should say, maybe that's not the right investment for you.
Yep.
Maybe it should be safer where it'll be boring. You won't have growth, but you won't have the potential for loss.
That's true. Yeah.
And you know, as you get older, as you get closer toward your retirement, you generally want to phase percentages of your money away from risk and toward protection.
Yep.
So you go from a growth mode toward protection mode.
Mm-hmm.
So I would, if I tell you my dad, who's 71, if he was 100% invested in the stock market, I'd say, who's your planner? He'd probably say, you are. And I'd say, fire me. No, just, He's not, by the way. But anyway, but generally, you know, you should have whatever you deem the appropriate exposure to investments. You pretend you're a horse on the racetrack.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why they have those blinders on, and you just look ahead. And what's going on around you does not matter.
Mm-hmm.
You're always focusing on your next step.
Yeah.
And that's all you do.
Mm-hmm.
And you can watch more enjoyable programming on TV.
Yeah, you really can.
You really can. So,
you know, if you don't have a whole lot of money and you didn't have any, and therefore you're not in the investment market, you know, I mean, fortunate for you because you didn't have to put up with all of the news saying, oh, we lost, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, 1,100 points today, you know, and all of the screaming that was going on and the paper that was flying around down on New York Stock Exchange. But, you know, maybe you put it into a 401k or that's guided by something. Maybe you have money in a savings account and you're hoping the interest rates will somewhere along the line come back. Wait a few years, by the way, on that one. So, I mean, there are lots of things that you could put money into and have very little risk. Or you put it under your mattress. There's a great risk on that.
Yeah.
Fire and theft will take care of that right away. But I personally think, you know, you don't have to have a whole lot of money. I know that when I was in college and we didn't have a whole lot of money, we decided to study the stock market. And this was a bunch of fraternity brothers sitting around a table having a beer going, hey, let's look at the stock market. So we decided to form an investment club. We had 10 of us deciding that we were going to form an investment club, and so we went to a broker dealer that you know had a license to buy stuff, and told him what we would like to do, and he said, hey, that's great. And he came out for about an hour and told us kind of what we should look at and what we should study and what we should read and all of those types of things. And then we began pooling our money together, and we always pooled it together evenly so that it was divisible by 10. Whatever we had was divisible by 10. And every month, three of us had the responsibility of investigating and reporting on a stock, a company. And we just looked around life is all we did. We just saw, you know, you go to the grocery store and you look at things that are being bought a lot, and you realize, oh, that's General Mills. Well, I'll investigate General Mills and see what General Mills is all about, and I'll look at that. Well, you know, mine was Warner Brothers.
Wow.
And I went to the movies and stuff, and I thought, well, you know, Warner Brothers is a lot of film or a lot of movies out. I'm going to investigate Warner Brothers and see what Warner Brothers is all about. This is when Warner Brothers was just a movie studio.
They were not Time Warner.
They were not
AOL. They were none of that.
So we decided, you know, after the investigation of it, that two things held up for Warner Brothers. Number one, they made good movies and earned good box office revenues.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, they had the patent on all the cameras that anybody used to make movies. They owned the patent and the trademarks, and anybody that wanted to make any kind of movie at any time at that point in time had to rent from Warner Brothers the cameras to make those movies.
Wow.
So I thought, well, that's a good thing to do, and so we bought into Warner Brothers. I think at that point in time it was maybe $20 a share. Well, you got 10 guys, you each throw in 20 bucks. All of a sudden, you got a pool of enough money to go out and buy 10 shares or 12 shares, and that interests the broker enough to be able to do that. Obviously, it proved very well, because eventually, over a period of time, not only did it grow, it got the attention of Time. Time bought it, became Time Warner. AOL got the attention of everybody else. They bought Time and Warner, so it ended up AOL Time Warner. It eventually was all torn apart and sent in different directions again. But instead, what they got involved in cable TV, they got involved in a lot of different things, and it continued to grow. So you don't have to have a lot of money. You just have 9 friends and 10 bucks apiece, and every month 3 people go out and take a look at what are we going to invest. And the only reason that I say this is, the other evening I was talking with some ladies. We were talking about what's going on within the environment, what's going on within capital and investment and everything. What they are is investment capitalists. And they started out with a little bit of money, and they pulled it all together and formed an angel fund group with these women, and they are now, after about 10 years, one of the largest angel fund investors in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. But they took a little bit of money each month, and they pooled it into this pool, and then they would invest it into a small company or invest it into small investments or whatever that, you know, got their attention. And over time, it grew astronomically, and it got to the point where they said, you know, there's this person that needs a little bit of seed money to get their company going. We really like the idea. We will help them out with various things. We'll invest in it. And, of course, they take a 40% position in that company. The company grew. They got their money back. And they grew from there. They became very wealthy doing that.
Wow. You know, what you described in college is no different than you see youngsters in school age do now.
Yeah.
You know, high schools, even junior high schools, middle schools here in DFW will do with kids, and they'll say, pick something you know, and they'll say, if you're gonna even play invest, it should be somebody you know something about. So yeah, when you said should have invested in Apple yesterday, well, as if we don't think of the Apple being ubiquitous enough, because let's see, how many Apple devices does the two of us have?
We've got four of them sitting over here.
I've got two right here.
That's six on the table.
Countered by one IBM and one HP.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. So we've got two computers. We have two traditional computers, and then we have six Apple devices, which are all computers themselves, sitting on here. As if that was not enough, the news that they could be going into car manufacturing or making driverless cars, which, of course, sounds off the wall. Probably about as off the wall as holding up a tablet did 20 years ago. I'm going to hold up, it looks like a newspaper, or it looks like I'm holding a folder, but it'll have a screen on it. And I'll just be able to touch it with my hands, and it'll do all these
things.
You
know what is interesting about that? And here's what I find very, very interesting. In the late 60s, and certainly in the early 70s, some of us on television watched a movie or a television program called Star Trek. And the captain would be sitting in the chair, and periodically an engineer would come over for an okay on something, and they would hand him a tablet, an electronic computerized tablet, and he would sign it with his finger or touch it on the screen, and off they would go. The iPad, as we know it today, first came out in 2010, 5 years ago.
Yep.
5 years ago.
And so You think about that, Star Trek is science fiction, and yet, in a way, that was a great, not just maybe a predictor, but maybe it was an inspiration for the technology that is so central to everything.
I'm waiting for teleportation.
I'm just waiting for legitimate hair growth products. No, I'm just kidding. we can figure out tablets and all of that, and we can't figure that. No, seriously, when I'm reading about Apple poaching engineers from Tesla and from a few other car manufacturers, and focus specifically on driverless technology, I'm sure a lot of people would say, "What does a phone and computer maker think they're going to do with cars?" And you know what? If there's one thing I've learned over the last 30 years or so, don't bet against Apple.
Don't doubt them.
Don't bet against Apple. When they start making investments in people assets, that generally translates into something. And great vision. I know, despite the fact that their founder is no longer around, they've got such an incredible machine that Apple is. So,
well, it was the very, very same thing as, you know, when Steve Jobs walks up on the stage with the very first iPod, which was the first thing that he brought out, and basically said, this is going to revolutionize the music industry, and everybody laughed, thinking, oh, yeah, we're almost going to give up our CDs and our DVDs and all the other stuff, and look at the music industry today.
Oh,
buy it all from iTunes.
Yep, you got it, so. Anyway, well, why don't we segue into college? I just want to make sure We gave that as our public service announcement, not to panic.
Not to panic.
But you know what? There's plenty enough panic if you are a family of a youngster, a young adult who is getting ready to go off to college, or they're in high school right now. My daughter is a sophomore in high school, and so I've got the knowledge that 3 years from right now, my daughter will be going off to college. And then 4 years behind her, my son will be following suit. How do I know this? Because that's exactly what happens.
Yeah.
Going to college was not a choice in my family growing up. Just as for their mom, it was not a choice. It was, you're going to college. And we've explained to our kids that that is their life, you know, their lot. Sorry, it's not even a choice. You'll thank us later. But today, I'm sure there's a lot of kids saying, really, should I thank you for having the opportunity to spend more money than you did on your last house? That's an interesting question, right? And it's, we've got $1.2 trillion of student loan debt that's on the books right now. The only debt larger for consumers would be mortgage debt. But several years ago, the student loan debt overtook revolving consumer debt, which is our credit cards. Think about what we do on a monthly basis on credit cards, and there's more in college student loans than what we do each month on credit cards. Which is shocking. That it just blows your mind when you think about it. So $1.2 trillion of student loans, of which more than half of this, well, it's all originated recently, but if you go back 7-8 years ago, it was less than half. We were not at $600,000. And so you say, well, is that partly because of the recession? Well, yeah, it is partly because of the recession, and his family has lost a lot of assets and equity and their home and their investments. They told this most recent generation of kids, you're going to have to pay for college yourself. You're going to have to borrow your way through.
Yeah.
So now we're graduating kids with more debt than ever before, historically. And what that will mean long term is we're going to have, you know, and whether we call them millennials or whatever the next name of a group, but we are going to have kids who are going to grow up feeling like indentured servants. And how long will it take for me to pay off the massive debt that I accrued during college before I can actually start earning a living and buying stuff for myself? So has the sky fallen there yet? No, it hasn't. And yet you should be paying very, very critical attention. And if you are a parent, you could be an upcoming college student or a parent of one of those, you need to be focused right now on what's going on in the marketplace. And it's not enough to hear, well, sooner or later, online courses mean a lot of college costs are going down. It doesn't matter. You care about what's going on right now. And you can just survey what are the costs of community colleges in your community, what are the costs of public four-year schools, what are the costs of private schools, and you'll be able to start figuring things out pretty quickly right there, what may or may not be affordable right away. So, and at Navicourt Solutions, we do student loan counseling, and we'll review with somebody. We'll say, well, let's look at your top 5 or 10 potential destinations. And by the way, not just Navicourt Solutions, but I'll say you want a real easy tool, the CFPB. You go to consumerfinance.gov or CFPB.gov, and you look up their student loan Know Before You Owe. And they've got easy comparison sheets, and they've got college lookups where you can type in Baylor University and University of Texas at Austin and Southern Methodist University and Texas Christian University and so on and so forth. And I'm just listing things in and around us here in Texas. You can start doing out-of-state for other schools. You start listing private schools. You say, all right, I'd like to compare my in-state tuition at UT Austin to Harvard. And I'll be going out-of-state to Harvard. And Harvard was going to probably be a little bit more expensive even if I was in-state. So there you go.
Yep.
You start looking toward community colleges. Some people may be looking at technical skills, schools, trade schools. Some people may even be looking at a for-profit college, which I hope I didn't sound too dismissive there, but these are some of the ones that have the highest default rates and lowest graduation rates. But some people are graduating from them, and I'm sure now is not the time to go there. What I'd say is you start figuring out what the market holds, and then you start figuring out what can you actually afford based on your savings or your income, whether that you being the student or you being the parents talking with the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start navigating what does this mean as far as my gap that I have to borrow, and what are the interest rates, and what are the different types of loans and aid, unless you have ability to get scholarships, you know, or there's other grants. Or you say, well, I've got to start working, and it may change my timeline for going to school, which, by the way, is an acceptable option for many to say, I've got to work a little bit to save up the money so I don't accrue debt. It may, for some, say, I'm going to enlist in the military so that I can have Uncle Sam pay for my school years later. There's all sorts of ways to look at this, but I think it's so critically important that right now, parents, sit down with your kids and do a little research and have the conversation about what they want to do, what they want to study, but more importantly, if there's any expectation that you're part of this financial equation, how much you can afford to pay. Legitimately, by the way, how much you can afford to pay. I say this because my parents always said, Todd, you go to college, you get in, you go to college, and we'll cover the costs. And I was very thankful for that. I did not anticipate that 2 years after I graduated from college that my parents would file bankruptcy. And guess what? The student loan debt that they had signed off on, of course, is not dischargeable in bankruptcy. So even though they thought they'd gotten through the worst of it, they still had liability. And then to make it worse, my dad thought, well, I can take care of the remaining stuff that's not discharged to bankruptcy. I'll cash out a KEO account, which is something you don't want to do because it's very punitive as far as the fees and the taxes are concerned. Which really complicated my parents' life, that after bankruptcy, they found themselves hit with a massive tax liability, which, just like the student loan debt, would not have been dischargeable through bankruptcy. So they think, well, we've hit rock bottom, but wait, there's more. It's like a game show in reverse. And they had to figure their way out of that.
Yeah, and there's, you know, you hit on a couple of what I would call very key points that not everybody that when they graduate from high school knows what they want to do, to be candid. And certainly a lot of parents would love to have their child go to college. And, you know, because that is the way we can see more and more jobs are requiring you to have a degree these days. We put some of those statistics up on our website for the Blog Talk Radio. And a lot of people would like to see their kids go to college because it adds a little bit of credence to parenthood, where you can say, my child graduated from college. But I think that what I heard from Todd, and it's important, is that not everybody right away out of high school may be in the inclination to, I want to now go for another 4 years of school. They may want to take a little bit of time off and do something else. They may need a break. And there's nothing really wrong with that. I mean, I wouldn't penalize anybody for that. I would say if you're just going to sit around and play video games, that might not be the best thing for you to do. But a couple of things that I ran into over the weekend, which I thought, you know, these were marvelous ideas. There was a kid graduated from high school, really didn't know what he wanted to do. Yeah, he played a lot of video games. He really liked computers, but he really didn't know what direction to take that. Looked at a lot of the universities, and it was the typical computer science courses, the first 2 years, of course, being the really boring requirements that you need to get out of the way, but it makes you a well-rounded individual. That's the whole style of that type of schooling. And then you get into your major subjects of college and computer science. he decided that what he wanted to do was take a job with one of the computer gaming companies that's in the neighborhood. And it was just, it was a really low-level job. He was hardly paid anything for this low-level job. But he started working there and really enjoyed working there and talking with all of the people that were there and the degrees that were running around the building as far as people that were programming all of these computer games. And in talking with the employer, found that the employer, after working there for a period of 2 years, would begin to pay for his college.
Wow.
And so if he took courses, then when he finished the course, he would have a passing grade. Now, this employer is pretty lenient. Passing grade is C or better. But if they had a passing grade, he would then reimburse them for the cost of their tuition and books and really the cost of the entire course.
That would have covered three-fourths of my college education.
Yeah, I mean, it was just absolutely amazing. I couldn't believe that this guy would, but this is what he does. And a lot of people let that money go by the wayside. They don't even look at it. It's like grants and scholarships that nonprofit organizations give out for people to go to school, and they don't use them. Because they never apply for them, and so the money just sits there, and it's never awarded to anybody. But in this case, he was basically doing what you would consider an apprenticeship. And there are a lot of people that do that. A lot of automobiles today are getting to be very, very, very sophisticated. And to fix those automobiles, you need very highly technical skills and many of it computer skills. The more technical they get, the more computer skills that you need to fix an automobile. So if what you want to do is do a lot of things with your fingers and your mind, in essence you want to build cars of some sort, you can very easily go and talk with a dealership that has a large service bay. Maybe they're hiring, and begin working with them. And you're not going to be working on the cars. You're going to be working on stuff around the building and everything else. But at the same time, you're going to be working with people that are working on these types of things. It may be plumbing, it may be electrical, whatever your apprenticeship is. And sometimes those companies will pay for your education. If you work for them for a period of time, they begin to pony up some money. I know that we do that here at Cornerstone Credit Union League.
Really?
After a period of I think it's 2 years, if you decide that what you want to do is go back and finish out your bachelor's degree or you want to get a master's degree, you take the courses, you pay for the courses, and when you bring the grades back in, if you have a passing grade of C or better, you're reimbursed for that.
Wow.
And there's a young lady that's here that only had an associate's degree when she started, and she has now finished her bachelor's program and is working on her master's program. And it's being paid for as she's working during the day. So, you know, does she have a social life? Probably not a whole lot. She goes home in the evenings and studies. She's on the weekend. She studies. She goes to classes in the evening or on the weekend to fulfill the requirements. But still, it's not coming totally out of her pocket.
It's not at all.
Yeah.
And what, I mean, that could be worth more than her salary herself, depending on where she's going to take the class of that.
Yeah, I know. We did that, for example, at EDS. And one of the reasons that we did this at EDS is when we hired people in, and typically we would hire them in with an associate's or bachelor's degree in computer science. That's what we were looking for. But we realized that even with a bachelor's degree in computer science, they didn't have the skill sets that we needed. So we would run them through another 15-month program, which was basically stylized like a master's program in computer science, to get them to learn the languages and also the skill sets needed to do various types of programming, such as general ledger and accounting, or automobile manufacturing or whatever it might be. And we would pay for that. The spin out of it was is that if we put you through this program, on the other end of us on the other end of it, you continue to work for us for a 3-year period of time, and we forgave all of the, so we upfronted all the money, and then all you had to do is work for another 3 years, and it was entirely paid for.
That's incredible. Well, so Rick, you've just given all of our listeners what a unique and interesting path if you're freaked out about the cost of college.
Yeah.
that you could explore. Mm-hmm. So, all right, if not, I want you to go to cfpb.gov or sit down to with a college counselor. You can do that through Navicor. You can do that, through, and there's many agencies that will do student loan counseling or college counseling with you. But the CFPB, their tool is really simple. You go online, you can enter in the name of a college, and it will populate based on in-state or out-of-state, tuition, room, board, books, activities, and you can do, I think, 3 schools on that screen, but you can compare up to 10 schools. They'll save the data, and it will show it all to you. So it's really easy. I mean, it's you don't have to do that much, you know, going and researching each individual university and who do I call to find out. So CFPB has all this data there, and it would give you an idea of the marketplace, and you can evaluate private school versus public school, in-state versus out-of-state. You can also look at the cost of community colleges, and you've heard in the past several months President Obama is a huge proponent of the value of a community college education, or at least using a community college to get into or transfer out into a 4-year school, which to me I think is such an ideal win-win, because you can knock out the first 2 years you're doing all those well-rounded prereq courses that really have no bearing. I mean they have bearing on your overall education, but you can knock those out at a fifth, a tenth.
You're right, yeah.
And then you transfer over to start your third year to the 4-year school, and at which point you're paying the full rack rate, but you've almost subtracted half of your cost of your total bill. Guess what? Your degree is still from the place that you finished from, the school you matriculate with all your major work from. So it's not about, well, how's it going to look if I went to, well, first of all, the community colleges are fine, but you're not going to even say community college. It'll say UT Austin. It'll say Baylor University, you know, and you can transfer to all the major state schools with those first few years. So it brings down your overall cost per year and your overall debt that you're graduating with. Why is this important? Why do I want to focus on this? There's what happens after you graduate, what I call the age of acquisition. And going up until about age 26, you're buying a lot of things for the first time in your life. Oftentimes, it may be the only time, or the only time in the next 20 or 25 years. So I think I told you last week, I bought a bed. And it was the first time I bought a bed in, don't think this is gross, I know, but I think it was 18 or 19 years. And the last time was during the age of acquisition for me. I had hand-me-downs before that, and then I plunked down money. I didn't have to go 18 years before I did that again. So anyway, kids graduating, they're on their own. Let's say they're out of a dorm. They're out of a frat or sorority, and they're living in an apartment for the first time. They're going to realize, oh, they're not furnished anymore, and you're going to need the bed. You're going to need the bedspread and sheets and pillows and all that stuff. You'll need the shower caddy and all the toiletries. Toiletries are disposable, not a big deal, right? But towels to use and whatever quote-unquote hardware you use in the bathroom. They're going to need not just the bed, but back in the bedroom, you'll need dressers or whatever to put your clothes in, unless you've got an awesome closet that has shelving and stuff in it. You'll be in an empty family room or living room, where you're going to probably want a couch or a lazy boy, a coffee table, a couple end tables, some lamps, and some sort of entertainment center that has a 90-inch HDTV that's streaming your computer and an Xbox or a PS4, and you basically are in a home theater system by yourself because you need all that. Well, a lot of people, that's the rite of passage. You'll have a kitchen. But you won't have pots and pans. You won't have your plates, utensils, and glasses to eat, drink, and cut with. You won't have a kitchen table and chairs. So I'm saying all these things are costs that once you graduate, you need to buy these things. And outside of saying the huge 90-inch TV, seriously, you'll need some base living expenses. And that all comes at once. It's not a matter of, well, you know, I'll wait a year on the bed, maybe I can sleep on the floor for the first year. And then after that...
That's always comfy.
Yeah, exactly. Trust me. Eight and a half months on a couch. When my back says, I hate you for the rest of your life. But
I will fix you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So why don't we talk about all these expenses? Well, they couple with, also during the age of acquisition, buying your first car.
Mm-hmm.
So even if mom and dad have given you a car when you left high school or you're in college, chances are by the time you're 26, you're buying your first car, which is going to be the first major purchase you finance.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you're paying for rent. You may eventually, and some people before 26 or by the time they're 26, end up getting their first home, which has a whole new level of cost. What else happens during 18 to 26? You're dating, and oftentimes you will get in your first major relationship. You'll get married.
Mm-hmm.
You may even have a child, at which point all the purchases you thought you knew are completely out the window.
Yep. Yep.
And you're just,
yep,
you're entering poverty.
Mm-hmm.
So now, in summary, with all that happens during the age of acquisition, and I'd even mention building up a professional wardrobe for the first time for your first job, on top of all that, if you said, well, I'm graduating with $100,000 of student loan debt, I've got $250,000 of student loan debt. And no, that's not including my graduate work. That's just the undergrad at a private school.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think you're going to have the money or the ability to finance getting a bed or a couch or pots and pans and plates and all of that stuff? It's going to really hold you back from starting your adult life.
Mm-hmm.
And many have said, if this is a generation, they're going to be prevented from contributing to the adult economy. Well, forget about the economy for a second. Just think about the individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine if Rick, somebody told you, for the first 10 years of your adult life, you won't be able to have a car, but you'll be able to walk anywhere you want? That would have a profound impact on you, wouldn't it?
Yes, yes it would.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Or if somebody...
It would change where you work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, everything.
And where you live.
Yeah.
You may have to live in busy city centers where
mm-hmm.
you can have live, work, play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so all that comes into play. If at the very least, if you thought this, how much I borrowed to put myself through college, could postpone when I get married or start a family in life, that should be significant enough to say, how much can I truly afford? Well, if you really, really wanted to be in forecasting, and I know no 18-year-olds know what they want to do with the rest of their lives. Very few may say they do. I knew what I wanted to be when I was 17 going off to Indiana University, and that was to be a doctor, and that's why I was pre-med. for the first year and
mm-hmm.
a semester, until I dropped and I had my first major change.
Yep,
so,
people do that.
Yes. So guess what? Mm-hmm. What if I picked Indiana University and I said, I don't care about going out of state or any
mm-hmm.
of that, because I'm going to be making beaucoups of money because I'm going to be a doctor. And,
mm-hmm.
of course, all doctors are rich. That's what an 18-year-old would think in their mind. They would
mm-hmm.
not think of the cost of malpractice insurance or the cost of running your own practice and
yep.
Or these student loans that you're being. You'll just think, I'm going to be rich.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So then I transferred into business because, well, I'll just be a businessman. And what you need a business degree to be a businessman. I don't even think I knew what that meant,
mm-hmm.
To be honest with you. It wasn't something I was very passionate about, but I continued on. I took some macro and micro and statistics and accounting and all of that. And then somebody told me, you know, you're working at the college radio station. Maybe you should be doing journalism or telecommunications or something
yeah.
like that. And I'm like, well, that's not a career path. I said,
it's
well, of course
it
is. It's not a job. It's not like you're going to work in that. Go figure that you and I both did. So, guess what? If I knew in school that I'd be starting out and I'm working in radio and my
mm-hmm.
first job may be making, it was hourly on overnights.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they made me a full-time, which, by the way, at the radio station I worked at, full-time was still 29 and a half hours so that they wouldn't have to give you benefits. Yes. But I would know.
Yeah, you gotta love them.
I'd be able to predict what my income would be and say, how much of a student loan could I afford?
Mm-hmm.
Do this with your parents. And you don't have to say based on a job, based on an industry, but you could just say, based on this, the amount of money we're going to have to borrow, here's what I think your student loan payment would be Once your grace period, your 6 months are up, you start making payments. You say, all right, if you finance this much, it may be $500 a month. It may be $1,000 a month. It may be $1,500 a month. And they say, all right, what do you think your cost of living is going to be? And what are you going to be able to do with that degree that's going to help you afford all your cost of living and this, I don't know, $1,500 a month for the next 5 years on your student loans? And then, of course, you can start talking later about, what if I stretch this out and it's a 10-year plan to pay this off and that frees up and I don't need as much money? Yes, you can do that. And of course, you're taking a longer time to pay off your bills. You just want to be cognizant of all the costs of all your college choices and just think, how would you feel? Would you sleep well at night? Here we talked about the swan factor for investing early on. Would you sleep well at night if you graduated with a couple $100,000 of student loan debt? A lot of kids, I think, would struggle to get a straight answer there.
And I think that it sometimes it's a, they don't realize or rationalize how big that number is and how long it takes to pay that off. You know, you just take a look at a mortgage payment and realize that it takes you 30 years a lot of times to pay that off. You know, you look at a couple $100,000 in student loan debt. Well, you got 30 years right there. You have a house. You just can't live in it. You can't put any furnishings in it, and it doesn't appreciate in value, and you can't sell it. So.
And that student loan, if you had a couple $100,000, that will impact your ability to qualify to get that first home. Or any of the other things that we would talk about financing. So you want to think about the overall type of debt because it will impact other major checklist items in your life. Now, does that mean it looks really expensive? Don't go. No. Matter of fact, I want to make sure. I will vouch for both Cornerstone Credit Union League and Navicore Solutions to say we are both firm and staunch believers in the value of an education. It just means that you need to be cognizant of the costs and how are you going to be able to sync that up? How are you going to be able to reconcile the cost of that college and what your future income will be and your future expenses will be? And don't bite off more than you can chew.
Absolutely correct. Well, in the last couple of minutes, I want to give you a website. If you're at college right now and you're thinking about books, and there's a lot of things that you can do. Sometimes the books are online. Sometimes you can rent books. Sometimes you can buy used books. Unless you plan on keeping it for ever and ever and ever, I wouldn't buy a new book. But bigwords.com, bigwords.com is some place that you would like to go. Because it aggregates all of the prices of all these books on college campuses and gives you that opportunity that there may be a book on there that is $300 that you if you bought it brand new, but here you could buy it for $27 from some student and it's the same edition. So you basically are ending up with the same book and there's some writing in it. There's probably some writing in it, but I did that all the time. I never bought a brand new book unless I really there was one that I kept. That was my statistics book. I still have that book, but still, I would never buy a brand new book unless you plan to keep it for the rest of your life.
Make sure your book does not say property of the Half-Blood Prince.
Yes, or part of the library system.
Good advice.
So have yourself a great Tuesday. We will talk to you again in 1 week on Your Money, Your Matters.